This is IRIB.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Israeli forces shoot two more Palestinians during attacks in the West Bank town of Al-Khalil, as the regime escalates its crackdown on Palestinian people in the occupied territories. Russia expresses concern over increased activity of NATO in the Arctic, saying there is a risk of, quote, unintended incidents occurring in that region. Also, a new report says nearly half of the students interviewed in the U.S. state of California complained about getting bullied, including by teachers, for being Muslim. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. The Israeli regime is escalating its crackdown on the West Bank as tensions run high across the occupied territories following violent attacks on Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have shot two more Palestinians during their raids in the West Bank town of Al-Khalil. The regime's forces have also attacked Palestinians in the Silwan neighborhood of Al-Quds. Earlier, Israeli forces injured around 20 more Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured and detained since Friday after Israeli troops stormed the mosque and violently attacked worshippers there. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the raids, describing Al-Aqsa as its red line. Palestinians view the vicious raids and desecration of Islam's third holiest site as a major provocation, calling for international intervention to prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Political analyst Tariq Tahbub has told us about the contrast that exists in the international approach toward the situation in Palestine and in Ukraine. Let's take a listen.
Tell you the truth, the Palestinians are being left alone. The international community has abandoned them. The double standards regarding them and Ukraine and Ukrainians are very evident to anybody. Ismail Haniyeh, leader of Hamas, has called on the Security Council to protect the Palestinians and to protect their rights to practice their religion in Al-Aqsa Mosque and in Palestine. And there is nobody answering the call. Palestinians with their bare chests and fists are facing the mightiest occupation forces with their bare chests, and the occupation forces have no respect for the sacred Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the property of 2 billion Muslims. It's not the property of the Palestinians. It's not the property of the Jerusalemites. It's the property of 2 billion Muslims. And these few thousand young Jerusalemites are protecting Al-Aqsa and protecting the mosque from the occupation forces, while the government is sneaking in provocative rituals and marches by ultra-right wing, because the shaky Bennett government is depending on these provocations to stay alive.
U.S. media reports say Saudi Arabia pushed Yemen's former president, Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi, to transfer his authority to a new leadership council earlier this month. Citing anonymous Saudi and Yemeni officials, the Wall Street Journal says Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had given Hadi a written decree delegating his powers to the council. According to the journal, some Saudi officials had threatened to publicize what they called evidence of Hadi's corruption unless he handed over power to the council. The journal further said officials have confined Hadi to his home and restricted his communications. Back in 2015, Hadi, a close ally of Riyadh, resigned and fled to Saudi Arabia amid political strife and conflict in Yemen. That prompted the kingdom to intervene militarily to bring him back to power, but to no avail. In Sweden, another plan by a far-right group to publicly burn copies of the Holy Quran sparks new clashes for the fourth day in a row. Violent skirmishes erupted between supporters of the Stremkors party and the opponents of the blasphemous plan. 3 people were injured in the eastern city of Norrköping, and at least 17 others were arrested. Clashes and demonstrations have been held in a couple of cities. 16 police officers have also been injured since the unrest started. On Thursday, the Heartline Party held a rally in a heavily Muslim-populated area in Sweden. At a demonstration, the party leader burned a copy of the Holy Quran, ignoring objections from onlookers. Counter-protests broke out, with demonstrators setting fire to security vehicles after police ignored calls to stop the far-right demonstration. Stremkors is well known for its anti-immigrant and anti-Islam stances. Iran has summoned the Swedish chargé d'affaires in Tehran over the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. Iran's foreign ministry said in a statement it conveyed the Islamic Republic's strong protest to the envoy. Tehran urged a strong, immediate measure by the Swedish government to ensure such actions will not take place in the future. Earlier, Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran. He said the blasphemy was committed under the protection of police. Khatibzadeh said Iran recognizes the Swedish government as accountable. People in Pakistan are reacting to the ouster of Prime Minister Imran Khan, staging protests and blaming the U.S. for the regime change in their country. Mohammed Touri reports from the port city of Karachi.
People in the port city of Karachi hit the streets to voice their outrage at the ouster of the elected government. The protesters say the U.S. conspired against their country. While Imran Khan never sought sore ties with any nation during his short-lived premiership,
former Prime Minister Imran Khan has accused Biden administration in Washington for toppling his government in Pakistan, for not towing U.S.'s line on foreign policy.
Khan said that his life is in danger, but he prioritizes Pakistan's independence over his life.
Imran Khan had twice tweeted, or in fact more, but he had a clear message for the U.S. administration that we are partners in peace. We will always be partners in peace. We are partners in trade. We'll always be partners in trade with the whole world, with everybody. But we will not take dictation from anybody.
I'm here specifically to do my part in wanting and executing the Pakistan that we all want. And I think Imran Khan represents a vision of that Pakistan. And I personally, honestly think it's not his job alone to do this. It's our job, our responsibility to come out and do this for ourselves. That's why I'm here.
We've gathered here because of the sovereignty of Pakistan, and we want Pakistan to get justice and Imran Khan to get justice, and we don't believe in the fake government.
Khan says U.S. diplomats started meeting some Pakistani officials 4 months ago, adding that Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. was threatened.
We've gathered here to fight for a more democratic Pakistan, to fight for a free and independent Pakistan, to fight for a Pakistan that doesn't get bullied. That is our main reason for being here, for standing up for Pakistan, its sovereignty, and its integrity.
We are just here to support Imran Khan in this freedom fight. We are here to just, we don't accept the foreign government. We are here to support our Prime Minister Imran Khan. He came here with the elected votes, our votes.
It's a protest for democracy. It's a protest for justice and for rights and human rights. The world, people choose their own leaders. Every citizen has a choice, has a right to choose their own people who they want to govern over them.
Khan has called for a snap election and urged an investigation into what he calls the U.S.'s plot to topple his government. He has become the first Pakistani prime minister to be removed from office through a non-confidence vote by the parliament. Mohammed Touri, Karachi.
Russia expresses worry about increased NATO activities in the Arctic, warning that these risk unintended incidents in the region. The Russian ambassador at large for the Arctic cooperation has been quoted as saying that NATO's activities do not contribute to the security of the region. Nikolai Korchanov said the alliance's activities could cause serious damage to the Arctic ecosystem. He was referring to joint NATO naval drills involving Finland and Sweden in March. The senior Russian diplomat also pointed to the possibility of the two Arctic nations joining the U.S.-led military alliance. But he warned that a NATO expansion at the expense of traditionally non-bloc countries will not contribute to security and mutual trust. Russia has already expressed its strong opposition to NATO's eastward expansion. John Bosnich, a political analyst, says the possible NATO membership for Finland and Sweden is not to provide security for them, but to financially benefit the United States. Let's take a listen.
NATO had been designed as a defensive organization. Of course, it changed without any reference to the public in any of the countries involved. It changed to an offensive operation when they attacked the former Yugoslavia to try and rip the country apart and colonize it. Now we're talking about the effort to quickly bring in new members in the form of Sweden and Finland. And what does that actually mean? Well, to the people in the country, they're told you're being protected. But back in headquarters in Washington, what's really happening is they're counting the money. Because to join NATO, you have to have a defense budget of no less than 2% of your annual GDP. If they join NATO, every year from now on, they must contribute a minimum of 2% of $800 billion, which comes out to $16 billion a year. And that's not to be spent on their own domestic industry, defense industry, which Sweden has a very well-developed domestic industry, but they have to buy NATO-compatible weapons, which are all produced in the United States. Therefore, the United States, through this conflict in Ukraine, has made a bonanza, not just getting the access to Ukraine that they were seeking, but absorbing two new states and fast-tracking them.
The Russian Defense Ministry says its forces have struck an ammunition plant outside the Ukrainian capital as Moscow's military offensive against Kyiv is nearing its third month. In a statement, the ministry said an ammunition factory was targeted with, quote, high-precision air-launched missiles. The attack comes on the 54th day of the conflict, with Russian forces continuing their operation against major Ukrainian cities, including the second-largest city of Kharkiv. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says 18 people have been killed and more than 100 wounded in shelling in the past 4 days in Kharkiv. Meanwhile, two people were killed and four sustained injuries in shelling of the eastern town of Zolote. Ukraine says its forces in the port city of Mariupol are still fighting despite a Russian demand to surrender. Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal says Mariupol has not fallen yet, adding that Ukrainian soldiers continue to control some parts of the city. Meanwhile, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said there had not been any recent diplomatic communications between Moscow and Kyiv. He added the situation in Mariupol may be, quote, a red line in the path of negotiations. He also said Russian troops appear to have decided to raise Mariupol to the ground at any cost. The comments came hours after a Russian ultimatum for the surrender of Ukrainian forces in Mariupol expired. The French presidential election has roared back to relevance as voters are upset over the inflation crisis. Many are upset with the austerity policies of President Emmanuel Macron, though others are also skeptical of his contender, Marine Le Pen's promises. Rami Mazahiri has more from Paris.
The French presidential election was trending as an easy victory for the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron, until the unrest in Ukraine began. Macron's insistence on long-term sanctions for Russia exploded already high inflation. That's resulted in widespread hardship, resentment, and tough assessments of Macron's economic record.
It's clear that Macron has not improved the quality of life for the French. He's not responsible for all the problems he's had to deal with, but it's clear there's a big difference between what he's promised and what he's delivered.
The French election may come down to this. Who do voters feel will protect the average person from the economically explosive effect of long-term sanctions on Russia over the unrest in the Ukraine? It's not a question the mainstream media wants to discuss, but it is top of mind for the average person. Polls show the race is now a dead heat, with a soaring Marine Le Pen of the National Rally taking an opposite tack, promising to oppose Russia energy sanctions, which are wreaking havoc with gas, heating, and food prices. As the challenger, Le Pen doesn't have a record to defend, and she's escaping anger over the economic crisis.
Absolument pas. Pourquoi? Pour la simple...
Macron has absolutely not done a good job on protecting our purchasing power. The middle class feels that Macron has contempt for the middle class, and they also feel a great contempt for the neoliberal globalist banker Macron.
Macron's far-right economic policies provoked the unprecedented yellow vest protests in 2018. He only made minor concessions before turning to brutal repression, and the coronavirus crisis only aggravated economic inequalities. Abstention may reach record highs because many voters wonder if Le Pen would actually deliver on her populist economic promises. Her party has historically been aligned with neoliberalism as well. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A new report shows Muslim students in the United States face high levels of bullying, both from other peers and from teachers. Nearly half of the students interviewed in the state of California reported they were bullied for being Muslim. That's according to a survey conducted by the Council on American-Islamic Relations. The report shows that more than half of the respondents felt unsafe, unwelcome, or uncomfortable at school due to their Muslim identity. It says one in three female students who wear hijab reported that their attires were tugged at, pulled, or offensively touched. The report also found approximately one-third of students experienced or witnessed some form of cyberbullying. One of the disturbing findings indicated that nearly one in four respondents experienced offensive comments about Islam or Muslims from a teacher, administrator, or other adult at their schools. Public outrage continues to swell in the U.S. city of Grand Rapids over the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man by a white police officer, with demonstrators turning out for a fifth consecutive day. The protests remained peaceful, with the demonstrators chanting slogans and waving signs. They've been calling for justice for Patrick Lioya. The 26-year-old Congolese refugee was killed during a routine traffic stop earlier this month, during a scuffle with an officer over a taser in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The officer has not been charged. The victim's family is demanding that the authorities dismiss the officer and file criminal charges against him. The Democratic Republic of the Congo has also condemned the assassination of its citizen, calling the act cowardly. Lioya is the latest in a growing list of racial minorities killed at the hands of police. One such high-profile case involved the killing of George Floyd, which ignited widespread protests against racism in the U.S. and across the globe.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In 2020, the largest Pentagon contractor, Lockheed Martin, took in $75 billion from taxpayers and paid its CEO more than $23 million. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Lindsay Kashagarian, journalist. This article is published under the heading, More Than $900 of American People's Tax Dollars Went to Corporate Military Contractors. Here's the story. Most of Americans want their tax dollars to be wisely used, especially around tax time. You've probably heard a lot about corporations not paying taxes. Last year, individuals like most of Americans contributed 6 times more in income tax than corporations did. In 2020, the largest Pentagon contractor, Lockheed Martin, took in $75 billion from taxpayers and paid its CEO more than $23 million. But have you heard about many of American tax dollars then end up in corporate pockets? It's a lot, especially for corporations that contract with the Pentagon. They collect nearly half of all military spending. The average taxpayer contributed about $2,000 to the military last year, according to a breakdown of experts prepared for the Institute of Policy Studies. More than $900 of that went to corporate military contractors. In 2020, the largest Pentagon contractor, Lockheed Martin, took in $75 billion from taxpayers and paid its CEO more than $23 million. Unfortunately, this spending isn't buying Americans a more secure world. Last year, Congress added $25 billion the Pentagon didn't ask for to its already gargantuan budget. Lawmakers even refused to let military leaders retire weapon systems they couldn't use anymore. The extra money favored top military contractors that gave campaign money to a group of lawmakers who refused to comment on it. Then there is simple price gouging. There is the infamous case of TransDigm, a Pentagon contractor that charged the government $4,361 for a metal pin that should have cost $46 and then refused to share cost data. Congress recently asked TransDigm to repay some of its misbegotten profits, but the Pentagon hasn't cut off its business. Somewhere between price gouging and incompetence lies the F-35 jet fighter, an embarrassment the late Senator John McCain, a Pentagon booster, called a scandal and a tragedy. Among the most expensive weapon systems ever, the F-35 has numerous failings. It's spontaneously caught fire at least 3 times. Hardly the outcome you'd expect for a top Pentagon contractor's flagship program. The Pentagon has reduced its request for new F-35 this year by about a third, but Congress may reject that too. Most serious of all, there is the problem of U.S. weapons feeding conflicts in ways the Pentagon didn't foresee, but probably should have. The U.S. left weapons in Iraq that fell into the hands of ISIS, Daesh, including guns and an anti-tank missile. Even weapons Americans sold to so-called allies like Saudi Arabia have ended up going to people affiliated with groups like Al-Qaeda. Military weapons also end up on city streets at home. Over the years, civilian law agencies have received guns, armored vehicles, and even grenade launchers from the military, turning local police into near military organizations. Records also show that the Pentagon has lost hundreds of weapons which may have been stolen, including grenade launchers and rocket launchers. Some of these weapons have been used in crimes. Compared to the $900 for Pentagon contractors, the average taxpayer contributed only about $27 to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, $171 to K-12 education, and barely $5 to renewable energy. How much more could the U.S. get if they invested even a fraction of what they spent on military contractors for these dire needs? Most Americans support shifting Pentagon funds to pay for domestic needs. Instead of making Americans fork over another $900 to corporate military contractors this year, Congress should put American people's dollars to better use.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atar, the host of this program. This series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, also known as Imam Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Ali and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
So, and Shaykh Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, very recently, in one of the speeches of Imam Khamenei, he talked about a very important concept, which is Jihad-e-Tabyin. And so many people in Iran, inside Iran and outside Iran, were shocked by this, we can say, type of look at the world and at the concept of jihad. Because this is the first time that this term has been coined by the Rahbar and he used it. So now there are so many, we can say, explanations, commentaries and interpretations written on this concept. Of course, Rahbar in his speech gave us a very nice framework for Jihad-e-Tabyin. But this is good to be more familiar with this concept, maybe for the English-speaking people all around the world through this radio show, Viewpoints. Sayyid Mohsen, let's start with you, brother. What is Jihad-e-Tabyin?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when we talk about the Jihad-e-Tabyin, then we need to obviously differentiate between, there are two basically terms which are together. One is Jihad and the other is Tabyin. When we look at the definition of tabiyin, if we want to convert it into English, according to the law, they say it is an explanation that tabiyin means. If we look at the philosophical definition of tabiyin or the meaning of tabiyin, it means elaborating or elaboration. And in psychology, they say identification.
Yes.
We can merge all these things together and say tabiyin is all of this.
Okay.
It is explanation, it is elaboration, it is identification of the Muslim world in the other world.
That's right.
Or identifying, explaining, or elaborating the true Muhammadan Islam and introducing it to the world means Jihad-e-Tabyin. Okay. Now, the word jihad itself means struggling, or generally, you know, in the West, they know jihad as a meaning of fighting.
Yeah, negative connotation.
The negative connotation.
Yes.
Or
jihad, jihadi.
It is related to the war only. Yeah. But where we have Jihad Akbar and Jihad Asghar as well, yes, like the small jihad and the greater jihad. And the greater jihad is, you know, you need to control yourself and your wishes. It relates to yourself. But we know that since the Rahbar or the Supreme Leader has used this word, it is because before this we were involved in the hard war, which was with the weapons or the missiles or the armies they were attacking, the invasion of the countries. Yes. We have seen the the Crusade Wars.
Yes.
Before we had seen other wars. Nowadays we can see like the Russia attacking Ukraine. Okay. Ukraine.
This is a war too.
Yeah. Okay. This is a war too.
Okay.
But I will say this is the fourth war, World War. The war between Russia and Ukraine. It is not the World War, but before that we had the third war, World War, which was Iran against Iraq. Okay. And you know that it wasn't only Iraq.
Of course, it was Iraq against Iran. Sorry.
Yeah, it was Iraq against Iran. But with Iraq, there were 23 countries.
Yes.
So you can say most of the
Iraq
countries
and its allies.
And most of the allies.
Yes.
They had the war because we say World War to a war where we have many countries involved into a war, and we can see that. So according to my own definition, I define the Iran-Iraq or Iraq-Iran war as the third world war.
Okay.
And since we entered into the new arena, which is a soft war, and this soft war belongs to the beliefs of the people.
Okay.
It belongs to the will of the people. It belongs to the trust and the hope of people to
That's
the
right.
God.
Okay.
So in this soft war, in this new world, in this new era, we can see that enemies are, they have changed their style of, we can say, like, fighting. And the war has been changed from hard to this soft.
The ruling of the games is changed. That's right. Okay. So, Sheikh Khalil, let's get to you, brother. So, from one side, we got jihad. From the other side, tabyin, okay? Jihad, as Sayyid said, in the true sense of the word, is struggle or do your best, or it's better to say attempt or try your best in order to do something. Jihad, in the Western definition, has a negative connotation. We do not mean by that. But I think tabyin part is also important. It has to be cleared out. What is the meaning of tabyin here and jihad tabyin?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani la'ini rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As Sayyid Mohsin has already pointed out, there are two types of wars, right? One is the hard war, the other is the soft war, as we say it. Hard war is that conventional warfare, which is fought with conventional weapons. For instance, guns, tanks, jets, etc. And we are all familiar with it, right? Its goal generally is to either take control of a piece of land or some property or some resources like oil, for instance, right?
Okay.
Soft war is a psychological warfare, and it's generally fought through media. It includes print media, it includes digital media, and its goal is to take control of the minds and hearts of the people, the thoughts of the people, the worldview of the people, the culture of the people, and the values and belief system that they have. And also, very important is the decision-making of a populace or a population,
That's right?
Okay. This is what is the goal, to take control of all these things and much more.
Okay.
It targets the hearts and minds of the general population, and it's aimed at that cultural invasion. You know, this is another term that the leader has used in the past to, you know, take control of the cultural trends of a country or of an area or a region.
Especially from the Western world and the Western lifestyle into the Muslim lands, you know.
Correct. This this phenomena, the reason it was talked about, you know, the soft war is because it was being waged,
that's
right? It was being enforced against the people predominantly of the West Asia region.
Okay.
Not to mention that South America got targeted by, you know, the Western bloc before us. But, you know, now it's our turn, I guess.
Yes.
Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei discussed this arena of soft war in several different contexts, and it was done over the course of years.
Yes.
If you remember, in Iran, there was something called Sabke Zindagi Islami.
Yes.
That the leader talked about, right?
Yes.
The Islamic lifestyle.
Islamic Iranian lifestyle.
Right. Mubin Islami.
How many children you must have?
Right, right, right.
Yes,
and the Islamic lifestyle overall.
Yes,
and also, you know, preserving the Islamic values that exist in Iranian culture. Iranian, you know, culture, he said, yes, that we have to preserve those.
Yes. Okay.
Then if you remember, there was something called Ifshagari,
yes,
exposing the realities, mm-hmm, right? This was the next phase.
Yes.
And the context changed a little bit, but it was still that soft war.
Okay.
Then you move on to Jang-e-Rawani.
Yes.
This is, you know, psychological warfare,
yes,
right?
That's right.
As it gets translated. So if you look at the history, yes, of how we're building, mm-hmm, up to where we are today, then Jang-e-Rasani, the media war.
Okay.
Right? He mentioned that. He made this, you know, title, mm-hmm, and he said, now is the time to get into media war and defend yourself,
yes,
and spread the message of truth and
these are all parts of and subcategories of jihad, the general
of
jihad.
Of the soft war.
Of the soft war. Okay.
Right? Jang-e-Narm,
yes,
right, as we,
okay,
say. Now, Jang-e-Rivayatha is another interesting,
yes,
one. And this was a while back that the leader talked about the war of narratives.
Narratives,
right?
Yes.
Then, now we're standing at Jihad al-Tabyin.
Yes.
And we translate it loosely as the Jihad of clarification or the Jihad of explanation.
Explanation,
right?
Okay.
These last two that I just mentioned,
yes,
hold on to these because,
yes,
we have to discuss this, you know, hand in hand with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jang-e-Rivayatha, which,
yes,
is the war of narratives.
Narratives, that's right.
And then the war, the jihad of clarification and explanation. These two go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The war.
I'm sorry for those who are not familiar with the narrative and narrative analysis, because I myself has studied discourse analysis. You know, there might be one story or one news, but different interpretations,
mm-hmm,
or narratives out of the same story. Okay?
And this is exactly what I was,
okay,
just going to explain, right?
And what is the Western world is trying to do is that it wants to impose on the Muslim lands and the Muslim values its own narrative.
Exactly.
I mean, his own understanding, yes, out of the values. Okay.
Yes. So, you know, this war of narratives,
yes,
you know, if we were to open it up, it's a proactive,
yes,
or an offensive soft war strategy.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. It's a proactive,
yes,
and an offensive soft war strategy.
Yes. Okay.
As it said, if you do not set the narrative, the enemy is going to set it.
Yes.
And it's true for them, it's true for us. You,
mm-hmm,
know, our enemies and we being their enemies.
Yes.
Whoever sets the narrative first gets to win.
If you do not clarify your stance, they will clarify and explain a stance for you. And based on that, they will impose,
yeah,
their values.
I would request,
okay,
to keep the clarification,
yes,
term,
okay,
you know, separate,
okay,
from this,
okay,
right? Because this is proactive.
Mm-hmm.
And I
yes,
will,
sir,
explain why I said,
yes,
this.
Okay.
It's a proactive form of soft war strategy that is called the war of narratives. If truth doesn't prevail, and we know that from the verses of Quran, from the ayat and riwayat, right, the traditions of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, if truth doesn't prevail, falsehood would prevail. You know, you cannot have a vacuum,
mm-hmm,
right? And this is what's going on. Look at the example, you know, very quickly. Let me touch up on this U.S. den of espionage,
yes,
which is known as U.S. Embassy, right?
Yes.
If we would have properly explained it to the world proactively, right, the enemy wouldn't have been able to lie based on that incident where they defend their spies by saying that Iran did this bad,
yes,
and, you know, they trampled over our riots and they,
yes,
did not give us the security and so on and so forth, right? And the leader has mentioned this,
yes,
as an example,
yes,
right?
Okay.
Look at Iraq,
mm-hmm,
look at Afghanistan, look at Syria, right?
Yes.
All they have been trying to do is to set that narrative, right? And from our side too, what we're expected to do is to set that narrative before the enemy does.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is,
that's right,
the war of narratives.
Okay.
Very quickly, jihad of clarification.
Yes.
It's a reactive or defensive strategy in soft war.
Against what you said as the narrative war. I mean, when we are in the narrative,
correct,
war, we have to struggle for the clarification of our own values.
Correct.
Of course, you know, tabyin is different from tafsir or tawsif, okay? I mean, describing something or explaining. It's better to say that we want to explain what is our clear stance, isn't it?
Well,
the
war of narratives, the game,
yes,
there is,
yes,
is to take control of the narrative,
okay, very,
right,
good, mm-hmm,
and have your word out there,
yes,
right.
That's right.
This, the jihad of clarification,
mm-hmm,
it's a reactive and,
yes,
defensive soft war strategy, which means you have to counter the propaganda of,
that's
the,
right,
enemy.
Okay.
So the enemy has already done the propaganda,
mm-hmm,
right?
Okay.
Now you're at the receiving end.
Yes.
You have to counter it then expose the falsification and lies of the enemy. That's how it's reactive, right?
Yes.
Then clearing up the doubts created by the enemy.
Okay.
And there's a theme, if you notice, I'm going to mention it in a minute, that is common amongst all of them. Explaining the confusion that prevails in the society, right? Sometimes the enemy starts from somewhere else, and the confusion that it wants to instigate in the society is something different.
Yes.
They don't just come and explain or, you know, open up the Pandora box of confusion. Yes. Tabyin for us means illuminating the darkness, right? It means fighting the lies.
That's right.
It means removing the curtains, and it means revealing the facts and realities.
Okay, that's all right.
Right? So one common theme, really quick, is
that, make it quick, man.
That when it comes to jihad of clarification, there is a direct enemy involved, and you're responding to that enemy.
That's all right.
In the war of narratives, you're setting the narrative whether there is an enemy that exists or not.
Okay, that's right. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen. And Sheikh Ali, it was very kind of you for a nice explanation regarding Jihad al-Tabini and its definition. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Fi amanallah.
About you, IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Limelight. At the core of the fear of a possible criminal case against former President Donald J. Trump is the argument that he knew he had lost the election and sought to overturn it anyway. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Panel Suggests Trump Knew He'd Lost the Election, Eyeing Criminal Case. Shortly after the 2020 presidential election, as ballots were still being counted, the top data expert in President Donald J. Trump's re-election campaign told him bluntly that he was going to lose. In the weeks that followed, as Donald Trump continued to insist that he had won, a senior Justice Department official told him repeatedly that his claims of widespread voting fraud were meritless, ultimately warning him that they would hurt the country. Those concerns were echoed by the top White House lawyer, who told the president that he would be entering into a murder-suicide pact if he continued to pursue extreme plans to try to invalidate the results of the 2020 presidential election. Yet, Mr. Trump, time and again, discounted the facts, the data, and many of his own advisers, as he continued to promote the lie of a stolen election. According to hundreds of pages of exhibits, interview transcripts, and email correspondence assembled by the House committee investigating the 6th of January attack for a legal filing released late on Wednesday, 9th of March. In laying out the account, the panel revealed the basis of what its investigators believe could be a criminal case against Donald Trump. At its core is the argument that, in repeatedly rejecting the truth that he had lost the 2020 election, including the assertions of his own campaign aides, White House lawyers, two successive attorneys general, and federal investigators, Donald Trump was not just being stubborn or ignorant about his defeat, he was knowingly perpetrating a fraud on the United States. It is a bold claim that could be difficult to back up in a court of law, but in making it, the House committee has compiled an elaborate narrative of Mr. Trump's extraordinary efforts to cling on to power. In it, Donald Trump emerges as a man unable or unwilling to listen to his own advisers, even as they explain to him that he has lost the election, and his multiple and varied claims to the contrary are not grounded in fact. At one point, Donald Trump did not seem to care whether there was any evidence to support his claims of election fraud and questioned why he should not push for even more extreme steps, such as replacing the acting attorney general to challenge his loss. The president said something to the effect of, "What do I have to lose? If I do this, what do I have to lose?" Richard Donahue, a former top Justice Department official, told the committee in an interview. And I said, "Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose. Is this really how you want your administration to end? You're going to hurt the country." Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, also tried to get Donald Trump to stop pursuing baseless claims of election fraud. He pushed back against a plan from a rogue Justice Department lawyer, Jeffrey Clark, who wanted to distribute official letters to multiple state legislatures, falsely alerting them that the election may have been stolen and urging them to reconsider certified election results. That letter is a murder-suicide pact, Mr. Cipollone told Donald Trump, according to Mr. Donahue. It's going to damage everyone who touches it, and we should have nothing to do with that letter. I don't ever want to see that letter again. The account is part of a court filing in a civil case in California in which the committee's lawyers, for the first time, laid out their theory of a potential criminal case against the former president. They said they had evidence demonstrating that Donald Trump, the lawyer John Eastman, and other allies could be charged with obstructing an official proceeding of Congress, conspiracy to defraud the American people, and common law fraud. The committee's filing shows how some of Donald Trump's aides and advisers repeatedly and passionately tried to get him to back down from his various false claims and plans to try to stay in power. It started almost immediately after the polls closed in November of 2020, when members of Donald Trump's campaign data team began trying to break through to the president to impress upon him that he had been defeated. During a conversation in the Oval Office, Donald Trump's lead campaign data guru delivered to the president in pretty blunt terms that he was going to lose, Jason Miller, another top campaign aide, told the House panel. The president said he disagreed with the data expert's analysis, Mr. Miller said, because he thought he could win in courts of law. Jason Miller also told the committee that he agreed with Attorney General William Barr's analysis that there had not been widespread fraud in the election, and said that to the president on multiple occasions, the panel wrote in its court filing. In the chaotic post-election period, Donald Trump's legal team set up a hotline for fraud allegations and was flooded with unverified accounts from people across the country who claimed they had evidence of fraud. A Postal Service truck driver from Pennsylvania asserted, without evidence, that his 18-wheeler had been filled with phony ballots. Republican voters in Arizona complained that some of their ballots had not been counted because they used Sharpie pens that could not be read by voting machines. Mr. Trump appeared to be aware of many of these reports and would speak about them often with aides and officials, raising various theories about voting fraud even as they debunked them one by one. When you gave him a very direct answer on one of them, he wouldn't fight us on it, Mr. Donahue, the Justice Department official, told the House committee, but he would move on to another allegation. Mr. Donahue recalled, for instance, how he told Donald Trump that Justice Department investigators had looked into and ultimately discounted a claim that election officials in Atlanta, Georgia, had wheeled a suitcase full of phony ballots into their counting room on election day. Instead of accepting Mr. Donahue's account, Donald Trump abruptly switched subjects and asked about double voting and dead people voting, then moved on to a completely different claim about how, he said, Indians are getting paid to vote on Native American reservations. After Mr. Donahue sought to knock down those complaints as well, he told the committee, Donald Trump changed topics again and wondered aloud why his numerous legal challenges to the election had not worked. Jeffrey Rosen, another top Justice Department lawyer who became the acting Attorney General after William Barr left the agency, fielded this question, according to Mr. Donahue's account, telling the president that he was free to bring lawsuits but that the department could not be involved. Even though none of Donald Trump's persistent claims about election fraud turned out to be true, prosecutors will most likely have to grapple with the question of his state of mind at the time, specifically the issue of whether he believed the claims were true, said Alan Rosenstein, a former Justice Department official who teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. Alan Rosenstein said, to the extent that the prosecutors had to show intent, Trump's delusion makes that harder. A finder of fact could conclude that Donald Trump is so uniquely narcissistic and self-absorbed that he actually thought the election had been stolen. Throughout December, Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donahue repeatedly informed Donald Trump that both his specific and general claims of election fraud were false. At a White House meeting on 15th of December 2020, Donald Trump was told that people are telling you things that are not right, the committee said. Mr. Donahue personally informed Donald Trump during a 27th of December phone call in very clear terms that the Justice Department had done dozens of investigations, hundreds of interviews, had looked at Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada, and concluded that the major allegations are not supported by evidence. The House panel also found evidence that some of the allies most deeply involved in Donald Trump's efforts to overturn his loss were aware that their endeavor lacked legal merit. Mr. Eastman, the conservative lawyer who advised Donald Trump that Vice President Mike Pence could throw out election votes from states he had lost, conceded during a conversation with Mr. Pence's top lawyer, Greg Jacob, that his arguments carried no legal weight and would fail before the Supreme Court. A rejection of electors by the vice president would be a relatively minor violation of federal law, Mr. Eastman acknowledged, agreeing with Mr. Jacobs's assessment that even the most conservative justices would reject it. If this case got to the Supreme Court, we'd lose 9-0, wouldn't we? Mr. Jacob recalled telling Mr. Eastman, according to his interview with the House committee. And he started out at 7-2, and I said, who are the two? And he said, well, I think maybe Clarence Thomas. And I said, really? Clarence Thomas? And so we went through a few Thomas opinions, and finally he acknowledged, yeah, all right, it would be 9-0. The committee recently received documents from the National Archives that showed some of Donald Trump's activities on 6th of January 2021. Among them were a morning meeting that included his eldest son's fiancée, Kimberly Guilfoyle, who has turned over 110 pages of documents to the House committee and was issued a subpoena on Thursday, a call with former Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican of Georgia, and a call with Mike Pence, as he tried to persuade the vice president to go along with his plans. More than 150 police officers would be injured during the mob violence that would cost several people their lives. At 4:45 p.m., with the Capitol still under attack, on 6th of January 2021, Mr. Eastman wrote to Mr. Jacob, "When this is over, we should have a good bottle of wine and a nice dinner someplace."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.